was known to be Amin and honest, even after 13 years of fighting against him, Kuffar still used to leave their valuable things with him. The pagans of Mecca entrusted the valuable things with him, even after 13 years. When Rasulullah wanted to go to Medina, he had some of the amanat of these people of Mecca with him. He didn't say, you know, they have killed us, they have tortured us, we are running away from them, let's take this, you know, and make, you know, something for the community. He said to Amirul Mu'mineen, give these trust and amanat back to the owners and then join me. This is amana. So if there is a survey in any town in which we have Shia community, who is the most trustworthy in this town? If the survey shows that the Shia are the most trustworthy ones, we are Shia. Otherwise, we are not Shia. We have to be most trustworthy. Of course, at the same time, we have to make sure that we register loans. You know, Islam says you register everything, you do it properly. But these are just for formalities. When you give me something, even without any witness, without any writing, any paper, you have to be 100% sure that I may give my life, but I will not betray. This is the level of trust that we must establish among ourselves and extend it to other people, whether they are good people or bad people. Imagine if this quality is achieved, how much people would love us and respect us, and also for those who are interested in business, how much business would come to this community if they know that you are so much trustworthy.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of His way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Rabb al-Alamin.
يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي ما رايزك إلا تصيد عيتك وانسك.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum Pressure Campaign denied them access to the vaccines. And so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted the Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries, with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist, Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed that they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and reveal just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded. The referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement, and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom who wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to, which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had wanted to grant. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the north of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, will be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places, like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks, working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do. But they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced. It must be enforced by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. President said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000, or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. And it's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money and it'll be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans, such as a stopgap spending bill, in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. Stay tuned.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Starting the show, we'd like to give our condolences and our congratulations to the Muslims in the entire world, because as we know, there have been many, many groups of people across the world, in Canada, in England, in Kashmir, Pakistan, in Nigeria, pretty much everywhere in the world, are upset and grieving because of Shahid Qasim Soleimani. It's amazing because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah actually said that the world is divided into two camps, the camp of the oppressed and the camp of the oppressor. And I've never seen that more clearly than after the martyrdom of General Qasim Soleimani. Now, what the mainstream media is doing, and by mainstream media, we predominantly are talking about American-owned mainstream media platforms, and especially, particularly, social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. What these groups are doing, what these platforms are doing, is they are blacking everything out. They're stopping anybody from actually seeing what these opinions are. They are giving a negative press to Shahid Qasim Soleimani, and they're actually attributing things to him which are absolute lies. And this is going to continue like this as we see the development of I mean, is it okay to call it a war now? Is this a war? Are we in a war, guys? Is this okay? So, as this war develops, we're going to see a lot of misinformation. Now, I think that the public, generally speaking, are more—they're becoming way more aware of the fact that these platforms on which they exist in the virtual world are pulling a curtain over their eyes, and it's actually manipulating their ideologies. And people have become more understanding of that. So that works to our advantage. People are waking up. It's like Imam Khomeini said, kill us. Our ummah will only become more awakened. That's what's really happening. People out there are becoming awake. They're seeing that the CIA are liars. They're seeing that the mainstream media is in the hands of these American terrorists, and they are supporting them. So, Sheikh Ali, should we go to you first?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, thank you for the very brief and eloquent opening. With the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, things are developing on the ground. Now, if you notice, once we explain what a soft war is, if you notice, you would say that, yes, we are in the state of war. And then, looking at the recent developments, we just entered into the arena of hard war as well.
Right.
Now, hard war is, you know, that traditional
it's a military front.
Conventional military confrontation.
Guns, grenades, tanks, right. Bombs.
That's hard
jets,
war, right?
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to soft war, it is the battle of perceptions, the mm-hmm. battle of understandings. It's a psychological war.
Right.
Okay? This the prior is, of course, you know, fought with the guns and grenades, but the latter is actually fought with the media.
Right.
Now, when you look at media, there are different types of media. There's print media, there's electronic media, and then print media has several types, and electronic media has lots of types,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Now, when you go into electronic media, there are, you know, two that I would like to you to focus on. These two are actually the source of main information that people get in today's time and age. One is the mainstream media, like, you know, TV channels, satellite
news
channels.
News media, yeah.
Right? News
CNN,
media,
Fox
CNN,
news.
BBC, yeah, Fox, you know, so on and so forth.
Now, curse them and destroy them.
Right. Now, these
Liars.
Are the mainstream electronic media outlets,
yeah.
right? The other is, which I would like to argue that is bigger and has a bigger impact on people's psychological state and their stances and their notions, is the social media.
You think this has a bigger effect?
I do. In today's time and age, especially for, you know, I don't like to put it this way, but inevitably I have to, especially for that the age group that matters. We're not talking about people who are like 85 years old, 90 years old now, you know, just waiting
Sorry,
you know.
That's okay.
The age group... The age group that matters,
right,
they're predominantly getting all their information from social media.
Right.
They're not, generally speaking, sitting in front of television, unless they're, you know, watching a football game or, you know, basketball game, you know. That's, yeah, they're looking at television. But to get their information, to get their ideologies, to get their opinions, they're actually tailing and subscribing to different social media platforms.
I have an opinion on this as well, but Sid Mehdi, do you agree with that statement that it's, news media is a little bit more outdated and social media is actually more effective than news media? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I would agree with Sheikh Ali, especially for the age group that we're trying to discuss here. That age group will not sit down and watch CNN. They won't.
Yeah, just
sit
imagine,
down,
like, you know, people walking around with their phones. You know, all these smartphones have these apps. How many youth and the young crowd do you think would open up CNN?
Yeah, they have a BBC app. Oh, look.
Exactly. That's
yeah,
like
very
nerdy, right?
Right?
Or maybe somebody who's a political science major. You know, that's a different ball game. That's a different story.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, you wouldn't see that age group really.
But do you know what?
Gluing to
I've
television.
I've noticed that news media had its role back in the day. It was the main
Correct.
Source of that. You know,
right.
that's what you're going to know about
before social media.
On. Before social
but
media.
But as the social media
okay.
grew, trend
yeah,
changed.
Absolutely. But now I've noticed is mainstream media, the news media, has actually invaded the space of social media. That's where the majority of their voices get heard now.
Right. This is also because of the point I was discussing earlier that they even recognize that people don't sit in front of television to watch live television. Rather, they go for on-demand media. You know, it's a long discussion that we can have in some of the time.
This is definitely the era of, you know, instant gratification. I need to know now. I want to see it now. You know, click, 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 click.
So we have two fronts. One is a hard war. The other is a soft war, right? In hard war, we have America attacking General Qasem Soleimani, which is a commander, Iranian commander, who was invited by Iraqi government to visit, and, you know, they had some meetings.
Right.
Now, they had an official letter.
Yeah, if I just add really quickly, because it's important, but according to the Iraqi prime minister, General Qasem Soleimani was on a peace mission when he was assassinated by the United States of America.
Right. I found that out later. That's...
Now, this is, you know...
Just on the, off the, that point, though, that is what they're blocking out. You won't find that anywhere out there.
Correct. Because as soon as, you know, the government's come into the picture, you know, the legitimacy of American attack, which is already, you know, everybody knows it's illegitimate, but that legitimacy even gets more jeopardized because now you're invading somebody's, some country's airspace and carrying out an operation without taking that government into confidence. This is war crimes. America has committed war crimes. Now, and this is not the first time.
There's your headline right there. I mean,
now,
everybody
knows
that.
This is the hard war. The leader of the Islamic Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the day that Marshal General Qasem Soleimani got, you know, became Shaheed, he gave a statement and he said that a severe response will be given back to America.
Severe revenge.
So this severe revenge, right? Let me get it out.
All right.
This took place, but guess what? This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Excellent. Right.
Right. I, you know, right now with the shortage of time that we have, I want to talk about the soft war that we're part of, because there's not so much we can, as, you know, normal individuals, civilians, we can do in terms of the hard war, maybe.
Right.
Right. One can argue. But when it comes to soft war, there is a lot that can be done. And this is why what Facebook has decided to do, what Twitter has decided to do, what YouTube has decided to do, Instagram, so on and so forth, these mainstream social media platforms, they completely blacked out any voice against the United States of America and the oppression that they have committed, right? All the revolutionary voices, they were being quietened, they were being silenced. Right? This is on purpose. So I know there were several pages, social media pages that got deleted. There were several IDs that got deleted from different people. Some of them were ours, you know, just our friends, very close.
They're actually saying, they are saying that, you know, we're doing this because they're Iranian-backed. But some of these pages have been blocked from the UK.
Well, actually, I know personally a friend who lives in Canada, his ID got, you know, just disabled, and he was not even commenting.
Yeah.
You know, he was admin on some pages. So there was a complete operation, a clean sweep going on.
A purge.
You know, by
us.
These, right, by this, the social media platforms, and it was very much organized, and it was very much planned. Now, this is not a news to us, because this is not the first time that these social media platforms, which are actually monitored and funded and sponsored by CIA and by, you know, these rogue entities that exist today, creating all the havoc in the world and creating all the terrorism in the world, it's not, you know, a news for us. It's not the first time. But this time around, it was happening at a very large scale.
Right.
Right.
And this, it's immediate. It's very in your face as well. It's not
this to our listeners is that, okay, you've got a role to play. Go create an ID on one of these platforms or multiple of them and say the truth.
Yeah.
Get the word out. You've got a role to play. We don't have millions and billions of dollars that we can pay like CIA does to its people and American establishment does to, you know, those employees of it, which are actually whacking these pages and they're completely swiping it off. But you've got a role to play. Go out. Contribute. Make your presence realized. Make your stance realized. Go out and shout against this injustice. When they talk about the freedom of expression, freedom of speech, where is it? This is a funeral of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. So you gotta do your part. Go out and, you know, give a response on all these social media platforms, because this is something that needs to be done, and it needs to be done immediately by you guys. And this is part of that severe response, right? We need to respond to the enemies of humanity, and you being the officers of the soft war, you have to play a role and get your responsibility done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, Brother Ali, he summed it up very eloquently, of course. You know, I mean, why would you censor on such a mass level, right? I mean, if you are the promoters of freedom of speech and you're the promoters of human rights and these things, right? I mean, who other than the Western world really is always barking about these things? For example, when the internet was shut down for a few days in order to prevent terrorist cells inside the Islamic Republic from coming out and creating chaos and murdering people and burning banks, so they closed the internet down so that these people couldn't coordinate with each other. Well, the first thing that the Western media said, censorship, censorship, you know, right. We need to sanction Iran because they shut down the internet because of, well, what a bunch of garbage right now when you see that you went into another country. You broke their sovereign, you know, rights. You went in there, you assassinated a general, and now you don't even let the truth come out. And matter of fact, they're not even censoring, like, big news organizations. They're censoring
individuals,
small groups, small websites, you know, and censoring them. So here, of course, where did that freedom of speech go? One. Two, what are you so scared about?
Right.
Right? Yeah, I mean, if let's say, you know, I mean, even though I want to talk about that in another session on this thing that they're calling him a terrorist, right? Mm-hmm. But if you really think that he was a terrorist, well, you know, why don't you let the opposition say what they want to say? Let everybody say what needs to be said, and then right. People can make their own decisions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You keep on spewing your lies, we keep on telling our truth, and then we let the people decide. Just the fact that they are censoring this so fast and so widespread shows you that there is truth in what the rest of the world is saying, what the Islamic Republic of Iran is saying. And most definitely, the enemy is scared and they are running on their heels.
Dear listeners, it falls upon us now to get the word out there. When we can see that the enemy is attacking us on the soft battlefield, we need to take it upon ourselves, upon our own shoulders. We have to feel responsible for the deen of Islam, for the Islamic revolution, and for the cause of Imam Mahdi. And we have to get that message out there however we can, inshallah. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Oh.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Welcome to today's episode of Back to Reality, only on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Zainab. In the studio with me, as per usual, I have the honor and pleasure of having two very special guests, my brothers in faith and humanity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Sayyid.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for being here, Brother Mohsin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brother Mudaffar, how do you do?
Wa alaikum salam. Alhamdulillah, I'm good.
So today we're going to be talking about heroes. Who doesn't love heroes? Do you guys have a hero? Did you grow up having a hero?
I had one.
Really? Who was
it's
it?
It's always Imam Ali. Because my mother used to tell the stories.
That's beautiful.
And you know, in the childhood, I used to think like Imam Ali's sword is so big that like in a room that one edge of his sword is on this corner
on the other
the
end
other.
Of the that's
how I
so
grew up.
Pure.
Yeah, that's really I wish I'm envious.
Bro, who was your hero growing up?
I had multiple heroes, but they weren't
I remember, but I've forgotten. I mean, I remember you telling me, but
it's all those bad heroes that we're going to use as examples
for
how
not,
heroes
yeah,
should not
should
be
not
presented.
Be.
All those heroes were, yeah, they were my heroes. Batman, Spider-Man.
Exactly.
Probably
but
not
it wasn't
Superman.
Entirely
I don't
our
like
fault.
Superman.
I mean, in our I don't like Superman either.
Harry Potter.
The outfit just really,
Aragorn.
Really throws me off. Aragorn from Lord of the Rings is
yeah,
definitely
Aragorn.
My childhood hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. Followed by Batman.
Batman has to be one of them.
Mm-hmm. But in our own defense, I think it wasn't entirely our fault. It was the culture that we were raised in.
Well, they know how to present their heroes.
Exactly.
And I don't think we've learned that skill yet. I think we're very, very far away from presenting our heroes in a way that will be acceptable to non-Muslims. Because they've presented their heroes, and it's universal. It doesn't matter which religion you belong to. Our heroes lack a sense of universality, and I think it's like that by design. You can't really escape that. It's going to be that way, and you're going to despise, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam if you're not a Muslim, if you're not, you know.
But then again, that's what Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salam says anyway, that if I put my sword, the tip of my sword, on the nose of a believer, he will not hate me. And if I give mountains of gold to the non-believer, or the munafiq, his eminence says, he won't love me. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's why he's Qasimul Jannati wan Nar. He's the one who...
The
divider of heaven and hell, because he's the criterion. He's the standard for who is good and who is bad. I'll just say one more hadith. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, Ya Ali, if it were not for you, the believers would never be known after me. So Imam Ali is the standard. He's the bar, you know? And it's not his fault or our fault that he doesn't appeal to some people.
We have to also understand that, look, the heroes that have been presented to us are fictional.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not like the West has presented, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln as an idol for youths.
I mean, even though they tried for a real long while. Like,
they tried.
Like,
failed,
like they tried to represent
Christopher Columbus.
As a hero for
they
a real
tried,
long while,
yeah,
but then they failed.
No, nah, which kid goes, I want to be Christopher Columbus and wear a Christopher Columbus hat.
And kill all the natives.
You know, the main problem is, sorry I cut you off.
No, go.
The main problem is we need to go back to the reason, to the philosophy of these heroic characters
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, yeah.
The philosophy is because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a perfect, ultimate perfect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he made us bil-quwa intentionally perfect. So this perfection is in our soul, and we need to go towards the perfection. Now what happens is when we get mixed up with this material world, we try to see this perfection in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, because we cannot get to that perfection or achieve that perfection, that's why we make these characters. For example, Superman, Batman, they can do extraordinary things. And on the other hand, when we see religiously, for example, I give the example, we were talking about Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he spiritually reached to the perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why for those who are traveling the spiritual journey, for them, he is being the best example and the role model.
Yeah.
Even in the Sufism, we can see like they also follow Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, mm-hmm. or they see him as an example, as a perfect person or as a hero. Why? Because he spiritually reached to that level, and that's why he became Insani Kamil, like this perfect man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The saints, the prophets, the infallible imams, they reached to that level. Now, what is happening in this material world? Because in this material world, people are away from the spirituality. They do not have inner peace. In order to satisfy themselves, they're making these characters.
Fictional characters. Right.
And then they try to see their own like perfection into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we see like kids, sometimes they follow Superman as a hero, or Batman, or maybe a Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And even we had these obviously incidents that happened, like people they jumped from the, I don't know,
the fifth floor of the building,
and
Spider-Man.
Obviously they lost their lives, mm-hmm. because of these characters, these fake characters. And that are the consequences, obviously. These are the negative points of these fictional, you can say, heroic characters. So it's better to go towards the real examples that are set. And the more you go away from the religion, the more you get into the trouble.
Mm. If you'll permit me, I just want to kind of rebut a little bit. I feel that the lofty status of the A'imma and the Holy Prophet, and the prophets in general, can sometimes be too high for the awam, for the common people. Common people need common heroes. And sometimes we can find those heroes in fiction. I'm just suggesting this, and I'd like to get your opinion on it as well. What if the Muslim Ummah came forward with fictional characters of our own, which adopted some of the traits of the A'imma, some of the traits of the prophets, and presented that to people?
They don't necessarily even have to be fictional. We have all these martyrs,
mm-hmm.
all the companions of Rasulullah. They were far from infallible, but they took Rasulullah and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as their role models. They aspired to be like them, and they succeeded to the full of their capacity. You know, that's basically what you said, but
that's a good point as
like
well. Yeah,
I mean,
we the difference between us and them. Sorry, just a very quick difference.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. We actually have heroes. Do you realize
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
The enemy doesn't have heroes. After the Shahada of Shahid Qasim Soleimani, mm-hmm. do you remember what one of the Iranian spokespersons said? He said that who are we supposed to kill in vengeance for Shahid Qasim Soleimani? What are their heroes? They don't have any heroes.
Exactly.
So they have to, they're actually forced to create fictional characters because they have no heroes.
Mm.
For the point that you made about the prophets and us, obviously these prophets were ordinary people as well. They were living among the people.
Mm.
So even if we take them as a role model, there is no harm. For example, for Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, we have many stories which obviously being the role model for us when they were kids,
mm.
when they were playing. For example, there is a story how they teach wudu to an old man. Like they saw an old man mm. doing a wudu and he was doing it wrongly. So they both went to that person and they asked him, like, can you check which one of us does the correct wudu? And they both did the same. And he realized that he was wrong. So he thanked basically them. So basically we have these stories. If we have them as a role model, and yes, there is a point that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has appointed them as imam or the leaders. And that's why he appointed them, because he wants them to be our role model,
mm-hmm.
our heroes, not anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
In the history, yes, we can find someone maybe who was brave. For example, you gave the example of Qasim Soleimani. Yes, for the Iranian nation, for the revolutionary people, yes, Qasim Soleimani is a role model for now. But obviously, these kind of characters, they come throughout the history in different parts of the history. And they live for that specific time. But in regards to the prophets and the, obviously, A'imma, they're all the time.
Till Qiyamah we have.
It's a universal, yes, examples that we have. So I think it is better to refer to the real, we can say, characters, rather than making the fictional or someone who's been built by the people themselves. Obviously, you know, in today's world, we have this this sickness of getting fame.
Yes.
So
this thirst for fame. Oh, my God, I have to be known everywhere.
This thing has made people making different, we can say, like fake heroes for themselves, maybe,
mm.
or for following fake people, fake heroes. And there we see, like, the consequences is that the corruption is obviously increasing every day because of these things. You know, in these heroes, especially like the movies that are coming, for example, what do they show today in today's war? They show firing, fighting, killing, robbering. You know, the movies are made on the robbery of a bank, and then these
robbers are the heroes, and everyone
and
wants
the police
to be
are
like
the villains. So these things we need to differentiate. Obviously, there are some principles of life. There are some principles on the basis of that good is good and bad is bad. Bad should always be bad, and good should be always
good. Point.
Be
very
good.
Good point.
So we cannot change the places. So the problem that I see, which I see like in today's world, the movies or the heroes that are being, we can say like shown to the world, this is the main problem that I see. For example, you know, there was a actor, I forgot his name, like he always played the character of a policeman in the American movies. And then police caught him, for example, like breaking the law. And then it was the title of the newspaper that, like, the guy who always played the role of a policeman, he's breaking broken law.
Right, right. So basically, it's safe to say that no matter what heroes, what any culture has, they're based on certain values, right? And when we look at even the fictional heroes that the West has created, or even some, you know, legends that exist in different cultures, that person is always the bravest, or they're the smartest or the strongest in their community, in their village, in their society, and they set off on this adventure. And because of their honesty or because how kind they were able to overcome so many obstacles and save the village and then be known for the rest of history. Right?
Robin Hood.
There we go. He was brave and he was kind and he was a really great archer. And he wasn't even real, but they made it up to, like you guys said, to satisfy this need to look up to someone who has perfected a certain human value, right? What I don't understand is what Hollywood has been trying to do lately, turning anti-heroes into heroes.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
It's really interesting what's happening right now
in
Hollywood, because I think they've kind of, to an extent, run out of themes to explore. So now they're actually going down this dark kind of alleyway where they're actually saying, okay, these evil characters, instead of, because it's very difficult to make an evil character it's difficult to present an evil character and have his evilness justified. If his actions are not justified, then it's just not a believable character.
Exactly. So
for example, if you're trying to invent a bad guy, how cliched is it if you say, I want to destroy the entire world, right? Just because I hate everybody.
Exactly.
That's not enough of a good reason. So then they had to make these characters more 2, 3, 4 dimensional.
Yeah, and more relatable.
Right, but now it's gotten to a point where they're just becoming too relatable.
Exactly. Like, I look back and I see Maleficent, Megamind, Lucifer, the movie Joker, Suicide Squad. I look back and I see Shrek, which is an ogre everyone is meant to be scared of, and they scared us with them, like when we were kids. I look at all these characters and I'm like, Hollywood, what are you trying to do here?
And it's
right?
Really good to see how, you know, very like surface of your mind all this pop culture really is.
It's right there. Actual trend now. And I feel like they're trying really hard to push an agenda through doing these things. That agenda, inshallah, we'll discuss on further episodes of Back to Reality.
Baphomet.
Who?
Baphomet. You've seen the picture, the depiction of the goat-headed being, often say is Satan, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's pointing one hand up to the right.
And the
one
other
hand
is,
right.
Yeah.
So their actual saying is, as above, so below, right? And what the idea is, it's like the yin and yang of Satanism, you know? Good and evil, you know, they come together, and they're just both two sides of the same coin.
Exactly.
Kind of mentality.
You've got to find the balance between your dark side and your...
Right. So what they're actually trying to do is flip everything, reverse it. Good becomes evil, evil becomes good in a sinisterly, deceptively attractive way.
Exactly. And make it as human and as natural as possible,
right.
Something that no one can even escape. officially out of time. Thank you so very much, brothers, and thank you so very much to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Back to Reality. Until another greeting, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin.